Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind. The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
A very good evening and welcome to the Law Report.
Happy New Year to you at home, in the car, at the office, wherever you may be.
I trust that 2021 is a very good year for you. I think that for many of us, every day, SMSs, calls, you know, this person has left us, this person is in hospital. For those who find themselves in hospital, we wish you speedy recovery. And for those who've lost family, our deepest condolences. I hope that in your suffering you find mercy. And it's sort of, you know, a lot has to be done for 2021. And, you know, one of the other shockers of a colleague here at Kaya, DJ Wandy, that was really just a shocker. What a joyful and happy man, energetic, always smiling, always laughing, very funny. And to just see on Twitter what had happened and how quickly it happened and almost without warning was quite a thing to deal with. But I mean, you know, it's not just DJ Wandy, it's so many South Africans, and I don't want to lie, I don't even bother to look at the numbers anymore, because you know they just so stressing. But for many of you, it's not just numbers, it's a real thing that you have to live with. So let's all be strong, but also let's, you know, keep our heads up. There's a year to be lived. Let's live this year. Let's do what we can for the year. Let's change what we can. Let's, you know, it's going to be even more difficult, because you know we need to be more equipped for the year. We need to learn harder, we need to work harder. Everything that you thought you knew about life, you got to double up. Because you know, when I my scan of the world today, it's just so technology driven, and yeah, let's try to keep up. Let's try to keep this country going. We need to make sure that people who succeed us are find something, you know, something of a country or something that resembles a country. And all right, so let's kick off this year. Let's kick off with our show tonight. We're talking about workmen's compensation. We're talking about what happens to you, Afropolitan, when you get hurt at work, when you die at work, what happens to your loved ones. And some of these things may appear obvious, but a lot of it doesn't appear obvious to many of us, like, you know, how this is going to all be affected by COVID-19. I mean, that on its own, you know, employers put so many measures, you know, to ensure that we keep to the regulations, but we're still getting it. The NIMS are still rocketing, and therefore, you know, the dynamics then have changed, because I don't think, you know, so the question is, what happens to me when I get COVID-19 at work? You know, what happens to my leave days? I mean, the simple question like that, I mean, before you even talk about compensation. So I think it's going to be a very good show to learn. But most of all, you know, call us with your questions. Let us know what you want to know about your rights, your entitlements, some of your fears. And you may have, you know, a father that died at work, that lost a limb, a mother, you know, that you're wondering whatever became of any payouts that might be due to them. Or you may, in fact, yourself have been injured and are going through something where you are wondering, you know, where are you going to get help? And one of the people that inspired this show is a man called Njongo Ngalonkulu. And I'm going to be talking to him, because, you know, my producer Masego was on Twitter, and he just saw this very moving story. And we're going to be retweeting it for you just to, you know, get a sense of who we're talking to and what we're talking about. Because here's a man that says, you know, I'm an electrician, and boom, you know, this happens to me. But he'll tell you his story. So that's the Law Report. As always, give us a call, 086-000-0959. I'm quite impressed with myself. I still remember the number. So the leave has not been long enough. Hasn't been long enough. Let me welcome my guest advocate, Musima Resesemola. Council, good evening, and thank you very much for talking to me this evening.
Thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners. Thanks for having me.
Indeed, and also let me welcome Albert van der Merwe. Albert, good evening, and thank you very much for joining us. Sorry, my bad. Hello, Albert.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Are you well?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for availing yourself. Thank you very much, Albert. And also, you know, Njongo, good evening to you. And, you know, your story on Twitter, I saw some of the images that you have pinned on your profile. So Njongo, thank you very much and for agreeing to share your story with us. How are you?
Good evening, sir. I'm doing good. And thank you for inviting me to your show.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just tell us, you know, what your job is, was, and where you work, just so that people understand, you know, what you do on a daily basis, you know, before we even get into what ultimately happened.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. As you said, my name is Jongwangalongkulu. I'm currently employed by the municipality of Ndizana in the Eastern Cape, Ndizana local municipality.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm employed as a senior electrician.
Yeah.
Assuming my duty is on the 3rd of February 2014.
Sure, that's some time ago, yeah.
Yeah, then I'll be brief. Back then, my job description as entailed in my appointment was to I was in charge of I had subordinates that were electricians that were conducting the daily operations, like the electrical breakdowns and all that. So my duty was to make sure that all those operations breakouts are attended in time. We do meet the turnaround time.
Mm.
Reported directly to my immediate supervisor, whom I would, I would like not to mention his name on air.
Sure.
It's already mentioned on social media. So those were my duties, as entailed in my appointment. I'm an electrician in profession, so it's something that I've been doing for quite some time. It's not something that I've done here. So it's something that I think on my appointment here, I had like 5 years experience. So it's something that I've been doing for quite some time before my appointment to the municipality of Nizam.
So you are an experienced electrician?
I am an experienced one.
Indeed, yes. I'm talking to Njongo Ngalongkulu, and he's sharing with us his story and his journey, which touches very much on what we're talking about tonight, which is what happens to you if you get injured or you die at work, what becomes of your loved ones, you know? And for many of us, this is a really live and real question. And who actually qualifies for any kind of help? You know, you have somebody that comes in and paints your house for just that one day. You know, what happens if that person falls off the ladder and injure themselves and injure their spine and can't walk as a result? And that's something that I think many of us should be worrying about. If you want to ask any of my guests a question, do give us a call. The number to dial 086-000-00959. I've also tweeted or retweeted Njongo's tweet where he sort of shares his story, and he's got some images on his Twitter profile. So if you want to check that out, you can go on my Twitter handle, @Matwening Bill, or you can just go to the Kai FM talk and check that out. But I do look forward to getting some of your questions, because I think we've got some wonderful experts here that can be able to direct you and help you and get you some help, because right now we all need the help that we can get, all the help that we can get. So and then tell me then, Njong, what then happened on this day, this very unfortunate day, which I, you know, I'd like you to just describe in your own words.
Yeah. All right. On the unfateful day of May 22nd, 2014, I got to work in the morning. And then we received an. Oh, before that day, since I've articulated my job description. On a Monday, because the incident happened on Thursday, the 22nd. On a Monday, the immediate electrician reported of sick. So each and every breakdown or problem that arises on the network, I was the one responsible as the immediate person. So which is why I'm okay inside, but I'm the one who got injured, but my job description, the one that I articulated, say something else. So on the fateful day, we received, when we got to work in the morning, we received some calls that a certain portion of town had no electricity.
Yeah.
So as the immediate person, I was dispatched by my supervisor to go and attend to that, which I did. And with me, I had two guys. One was an intern, and the other one was a general assistant. So we did what you call troubleshooting, fault locating, which during the process, we did find out that there's a certain portion whereby something that we call.
Okay, maybe we don't have to get too technical. Maybe just get to the bit where. Yeah.
And then what happened was, I was busy doing some maintenance on the line. And then the way that it's supposed to happen is that anyone who's doing the job, once he's done, he has to inform someone who's at any point of control, which is point of switching, to switch on or switch off. So I was supposed to inform my supervisor and some ESCOM technician who were at the switch to switch on once I'm done. But before I did gave them that call, I got electrocuted. So that tells you that someone did switch on without my consent. Yes.
And then what was the, you know, when you became electrocuted? I mean, take me through that.
I got electrocuted by 22,000 volts. That is, we call it 22 kV.
Yeah.
During that process, you get soaked, and then your body freezes. You can't move. You lose control of your senses. You lose control of all your body senses. And then, because an electricity, when you want to get electrocuted, there must be an entry and exit point.
Sure.
Whenever an electricity gets into contact, it must find an exit point. So during that time, when it's holding you, you can't move, you can't do anything, that's where it's still trying to find any exit point that will be much closer for it to exit, and then that's when it will release you. So during that time, you could hear in your head the sound of this sound usually hear when you're passing by the the substation and the power station. That sound of roaring transformers and roaring wires. So that one is what runs through your head during that process. Until it finds an exit and then it releases you.
And what was the exit? What was the exit point for
Mama?
Yeah.
The entry point on me was through my left arm.
Uh-huh.
And then my exit point was just above an ankle. There was a hole, a protruding hole whereby you could see the other side, just above an ankle.
What?
And then that's when it released me. That's why I have to be amputated left leg and left arm.
So as a result, you when you went to the hospital, they amputated both your arm and your leg.
Yes, but the reason why, if you could see some on Twitter on my picture, the arm is amputated very high, just above elbow, of which the leg is amputated below knee.
Okay.
Simply because the damage was too much on the entry than on the exit.
So the arm that got amputated, is that the arm through which the electrocution entered?
Entered, yes.
Okay.
And then the leg, where it exited. Actually, the reason for amputation is that all the nerves are dead.
Mm.
So, on my case, had if ever, even if the nerves were dead, if the, I would say, there was still blood flow, maybe they could have kept the limbs, but already there was no blood flow. There was no blood flow. You could see that the arm turned, I would say, white.
For lack of a better word. I saw the picture, yeah.
Yes, you could see that there's no blood flow.
All right, and then you know, amputation happened. You were out of work. Were you reemployed by the company again?
I was reemployed, even though I was never even fired because I was injured on duty.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, they had to. I think by law, it states that. If ever there can be any more work that they can find for me, then they will follow some processes to release me from my duty. But I was re-employed, but doing other duties.
Yeah. And then what about, you know, you obviously have to live without two of your limbs. For the rest of your life, and you know, do you have like a prostate leg, or you know, what happens with your arm? Have you got some kind of aid?
Yeah, then with regards to the arm, actually, I do have two artificial limbs. I do have an arm, but the arm is I've stopped using it because it's so uncomfortable because. I don't have much control of it because part of it is artificial. There's little natural whereby I end up losing control over it. Mm. So I stopped using it.
Okay.
And then I do have an artificial leg, which is the one that I'm currently using on a daily basis.
And that's you have control over that? I mean, I was very involved in the Oscar Pistorius commentary during his trial, and I got quite acquainted with, you know, his prostate legs, which were a matter of some interest in the trial. Is it sort of at that scale? Or because I know there's those very old prostate legs, which when you describe the artificial arm, I got a sense that it's sort of an unuseful attachment to an arm, and that's why you described it as what sort of is it, that sort of high spec, high tech prostate or artificial leg?
I would say it's mid spec because Gazette is controlled by the Gazette. So if ever I need the one, I would say If ever I need the one that would be more suitable to me,
yeah.
I have to pay. Because considering my condition, the Gazette doesn't offer the leg that would suit my condition, because I don't have what they call the counterbalance, because my amputations are on the same side.
Right.
So, yes. So
okay.
I would say,
yeah. All right. I mean, stay on the line. I mean, I'm very sorry to hear about you know, your experience, but I'm happy that, you know, you're keeping on, which is something that life forces us to do. Advocate Rasasimula, if I could just bring you in here just very quickly. I want to take a break, but I thought before we touch on that, I mean, this is something that, you know, something that came up around an employer's obligation. So I get injured at work, and let's assume that, you know, the employer takes a view that they don't want me back because I can't do my old job again. When we come back from a break, can we touch on that just to talk about in some detail around what are my rights? Because I know for a fact that there are some people who get injured at work and then get retrenched because for whatever reason, the employer believes they're no longer able to do what the employer needs. So when we come back from the break, can we tackle that question? Great. All right, I'm going to take a break. We're back after this.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back to the Law Report. Apparently, allegedly, you heard what you shouldn't have heard. All right, you didn't hear that. Advocate Musima Rasasimula, you know, just before I took the break, we're talking about, you know, this thing about getting injured at work. I mean, take Njongo, for example. He loses not one limb, but two limbs, which you can imagine working becomes somewhat difficult. And for some employers differ. You know, there might be a smaller company that might not be able. I mean, he's working for a local municipality or district municipality. But for somebody else, they might be employed by somebody with a smaller budget, and who may have different requirements in so far as how far they can accommodate the person. So, and how does the law, you know, regulate this predicament?
Okay, so in terms of the law, you have what we call the compensation for occupational injuries and diseases Act, right? That essentially sets out a framework that says what should happen once a person is injured or is infected with an illness or dies in the line of duty. And what it does is that it empowers the Director General to then set up a sort of an equation in terms of which each and every employer is able to contribute towards a fund, the compensation fund, as some sort of insurance so that when a person gets hurt, then a certain amount is, it's, well, their application or their claim is assessed, and then they're able to receive compensation for that particular, you know, injury or disease that they acquire on the job. So from the moment the person gets injured, on the day that they're injured, it has to be reported to the compensation fund. And then, of course, as time goes on with the procedure of, like, medical assessment and trying to stabilize the person's condition and an assessment of whether they can, when and if they can go back to work or not, then a medical practitioner will then, at the expense of the compensation fund, will then have to declare when this person can go to work and what kind of sort of other care will they need in order to tend to, say, their injuries or in order to recover from that particular illness that they're under. So that is essentially what COIDA is set out for, in order to protect certain type of employees in certain situations. And this is to cater for instances where you don't want an employee suing their employer for occupational injuries or diseases or death, so that the employee relationship can sort of be amicable or remain amicable. Hello.
Yeah, so I was saying, what's the process when one wants to do something about this? Do I have to do something as an employee if I then find myself in a situation where I am I'm injured at work, for example? Is there anything that I need to do, or is it more on the employer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a joint effort. It's about collaboration, but it falls more on the employer more than the employee. So, like I tried to insinuate earlier, the first thing is to report on the very same day that the accident takes place, to report to a supervisor to say that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
What the employer will try to do is that, in order to just ensure good practice in trying to manage the claim, they must try to get as many witnesses as they can, and then they fill out a notice of the accident and also a claim for compensation on behalf of the employees. And then this accident report and the claim needs to be submitted within, I think, 7 working days to the compensation commissioner, together with a first medical certificate and a medical report from the doctor who attends to the person
mm-hmm.
who was injured on the job. And then the person will be given sort of a number, a reference number, that will appear in all their documents whenever they are calling the compensation fund through the Department of Labor, in order to inquire about their claim as time proceeds. But then if the person really, if the initial assessment of the doctor is that you got very, like your injuries are severe, for example, then there will be subsequent progress reports that are given out by the medical practitioner as they monitor your condition as time goes on. During this time, you might be at home recovering, but then there are subsequent reports that are handed out or they're sort of published, and they need to be submitted to the compensation fund in order for them to also keep track. And then after they receive all these reports and ultimately receive the final medical report that says that the person's condition has been stabilized or that it hasn't, then everything is handed over to the compensation fund, and they have to make an assessment in terms of the nature of the injury, the impact that it will have on the person's mm-hmm. future working prospects and so on, how much compensation this person has to receive, together with past and future medical expenses and all these other like pockets of compensation that a person needs to receive. But there are instances where the compensation fund might say that, but we don't think that this person must receive compensation, they don't qualify. And then in that instance, there will be an appeal process. And if that is not successful, then the person can apply for, like, using the normal common law to sue the compensation fund to put their decision on review through a court of law, or to sue, like, the employer for damages in order for them to compensate for their injuries.
Sure. Okay. Let me just. Albert, you wanted to jump in?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
I think it's important to also note that I think Advocate Masima is 100% correct in the procedural aspects of the injury and the claim. What we advise our members as an employer's organization, it is extremely important to look at the social well-being of the dependents of the employee. Mm. And as soon as the injury occurs and there is there's trauma, and for the family, the employer should set up a contact with the family.
Mm.
So that, there is this proper communication in the first place, and you as employer should determine what the circumstances are. If it's the main breadwinner, the most criticism against the commissioner at this point in time is the delay in the handling of the claim and the payouts that are made.
Yeah.
When you will understand that as soon as an injury like this occurs, I mean, what happens at the first payday? By the end of the first month, that claim will not be handled at such a stage where the compensation fund will start paying out and look after this employee and his dependent, because you know that employee has got bills to pay and everything. So what we advise our members to do as an employees organization is to at least financially assist the employee. And through this communication that you set up with the family and the dependents, you know, an agreement can be put in place to, at a later stage when the claim is at an advanced stage of finalization, then that monies can be claimed back from the commissioner, from the commission. But at least the family is cared for and looked after, you know, basically on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of employers, and I'm not talking about the responsible employers, you know, don't think of these things.
Mm.
And when an employee after an accident returns, there's also an obligation on the employer to try and find an alternative position for that that employee that can accommodate say for example a loss of a limb or you know the situation, maybe the employee is now in a wheelchair or something, to accommodate that employee. It is not always possible, but I think you know employers should look at the ways and means to accommodate that employee when they return.
Because, I mean, when you think about retrenchment in a normal course, it's quite traumatic. And a lot of people, you know, once retrenched, it takes them a long time to recover. And I'm not talking financially, you know, even just psychologically. And you can imagine if you get retrenched in circumstances where you got injured at work and even worse, it's because of somebody else's conduct, not even your own negligence. You know, so there's also a trauma, which I'm not sure if our law has considered. I mean, you know, our understanding of psychology and how it's, you know, I'm not sure if our law has quite embraced issues of psychological impact and effect, or I could just have it wrong.
Well, I think it's definitely something. Pardon me, I forget. It's really something that you know, employers, and a lot of the employers are doing that. You know, to look after the social well-being and also after the mental well-being of an employee and also their dependents, to try and recuperate from the impact and the mental impact and the psychological impact of an injury or of maybe the death of a breadwinner.
You wanted to contribute as well, Advocate Ressa Simola.
Yeah, I mean, I dealt last year with, it wasn't necessarily a case, but it was a legal opinion where a client was a mine worker and he broke, I think it was the femur bone or something in an underground accident. And there was the final medical report. It cleared him. It said his condition was stable and he could return. But he got back and, I mean, he couldn't even fit in the boots and go underground without his foot swelling and all of that. So it turned out that when he was in the environment of the workplace, his body reacted differently and the injury became an obstacle to him working. But around the same time, the mine was also shedding off staff because they were not making, like, production was low and they were not making as much profit. So those are also the other kind of problems that come up that sort of exacerbate the problem and the relationships between employer and employee. It's true that COIDA is viewed, and there's a recent decision by the Constitutional Court, that it is a sort of legislation that is brought up for also social assistance and social security, and therefore it has to extend itself towards those parts of a person's life that cover all social aspects in terms of them earning and being secure financially, but also being in a position to then work in a way that is profitable to them. I think as time goes on, COIDA should be developed in order to grow as a fund, in order to cater for all those dimensions, the same way that the Road Accident Fund, provided it becomes managed very well and then it recuperates its funds, is able to cover all those aspects such as the emotional trauma and the psychological injuries that a person might receive following a motor vehicle accident. I think the same logic can be extended to COIDA. It's just a matter of the legislature expanding it and being cognizant of the work environment and the fact that all aspects, including the psychological, are important for people to come back from injuries and perform their work.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking about what happens to you when you get hurt or injured at work, or when you even get sick. I know there's, you know, a lot of cases that, you know, are trying to be presented as class actions around asbestos and several other things where people just simply get sick because they've worked in a certain environment that was harmful to them. So what happens then? But also, what happens when you die? What happens when your loved one dies? What can you do? Jump in.
You know, just to add on what was being talked about before, you raised this point. The issue, the main issue that we have with compensation fund is that after 2 years of injury, from the date of injury, your case, I don't know, they say your case is closed. Now, the challenge that is there is that what happens to the shortcomings, like what you're saying, psychological breakdown and all that, for the extended family, for the family, I meant to say. Mm. If you discover, you experience the emotional breakdown, let's say two and a half years after accident, it's a process to get that case open. Because the case is closed. Then to get, in fact, I'm talking about my experience, your case gets closed for such, the only thing that that you get from them, if ever you have been declared as chronic, so you receive certain medication monthly, that one, it continues. But for instance, now I'm going through what we call pain management. It's a process for me to get that being funded by compensation fund, because my case has been closed 2 years.
What is pain management? I mean, is it? Are you talking about physical pain?
Yeah, it's actually in my case, it's, I would say it's a psychological pain, because it's a nerve pain. Even though physically the wounds have healed, but they call it a neuralgia, a phantom limb pain. So I'm going through that.
If it's your nerve, then it's physiological.
Physiological, I don't know.
So it's like it's physical.
No, it's not physical.
Yeah.
It's not physical, because they have to do, what happens is, it's caused by the damaged nerve.
Yes.
What is that I'm facing, and then the wound will heal physically.
Yes.
But psychologically, I'll say, I forgot the term, the medical
term.
But what happens is that the root of that damaged nerve, then you go through something that is called phantom limb pain, whereby you experience certain types of pain, like burning and whatnot. So that pain needs to be controlled. So as a result, I'm taking medication. But now, even if you're taking medical drugs, then you develop an endurance by you find out that they are not that much effective as they are. So you need to look for other types of managing this pain.
Sure.
And then others it's through the procedure, and then the one effective one currently the best pain treatment for phantom limb pain is called the spinal cord stimulator. The one that I recently went for, it's an operation.
Sure.
Compensation fund, because from the hospital admission to the doctors and all that, a compensation fund couldn't fund that. You have to write a motivation to pay to get the case opened, and then you have to wait for them to reply.
And I think I want to touch on that and just check with my guests, because I know with the RAF, there's a lot of, there's a computation of future medical costs, et cetera, when they work it out. So I'd just like to check with my guests when I come back how that is sorted out. I'm going to take a break. Do give us a call if you have any questions for my guests. 086-000-00959. I'll be taking all of them after this.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back. We're still talking about workmen's compensation. And joining me on the line are Albert van der Merwe. Albert is the Assistant General Secretary for the National Employers Labor Association, acronym NELA, and also advocate of the High Court and Director at Musima Legal Practice, Advocate Musima Rasesemola, who are helping me just deal with some of the questions that you may have. And if you want to ask them a question, do give me a call, 086-000-00959. I want to just, I mean, there's so much to pick up on, and maybe if I can go to you, Advocate Musima, and talk about, how do they work it out? Because it seems quite cumbersome that I should claim today and come back again and have to come back, because with my very limited experience and knowledge, I know that when you just, fracture your ankle, you're going to feel pain well into your old age, and I'm pretty sure it's worse if you've been amputated or something like that. How are future medical costs taken into account, and how are they paid out?
So there's they call it actuarial risk or actuarial risk profile or assessment. That is used for each and every industry, firstly, in order to determine what each employer needs to contribute on a regular basis to the fund, depending on how high risk that particular sector is in terms of the employees that are there. So someone who works at a retail store, the compensation fund contribution by the employer won't be similar to those that are employed in a mine, like in an underground mine, for example. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that they factor in are that, remember, it is dependent on the initial medical report, the progress reports, and the final medical report, and what the medical practitioner themselves anticipate this person's future medical expenses could be, and what kind of treatment they might receive. With that being said, I think the main difference between your road accident fund and your COIDA is that with the compensation fund is that with the road accident fund, it sort of looks at the motor vehicle accident and looks outwardly at how this particular accident has affected the entire life of the person. So it doesn't only look at how it affects my work life, but my family life and all other aspects of my life. That's why there is assessment of future employability, as much as they also do clinical assessments of orthopedic and all these other factors. Whereas with COIDA, it was an attempt by the Department of Labor to look at the injury and how it affects your work life. and your future employability, and it really restricts it to whether you'll be able to continue working or not. Furthermore, it is limited by that particular medical practitioner who does the assessment, who you are usually... they give you like a permission or a right to say where you would like to have your medical assessment being done. But it can only be one practitioner, and once they give a decision and an assessment on your injuries, then that's that. So I think that is the main difference, to say that road accident fund is more outward looking, and therefore it deals with multiple aspects of the injury and its impact, mm-hmm. as opposed to COIDA that deals specifically with the injury and how it affects that your particular role in the current work that you are doing, and it's the employer then making up for the fact that because you were stationed here, working here, then that's how you got impacted. I think it needs some reform, because definitely what I've seen with some of my clients while I worked as an attorney, what I saw with most of my road my clients who got injured in a motor vehicle while they were in the work environment, is that they'll be given an option to say, do you want to do a COIDA claim or an RAF claim? And they definitely always went with a road accident fund claim because of how broad it is in terms of the
scope. But that's why, I can imagine somebody who doesn't have legal advice would probably opt for worksman's compensation. But, you know, with legal advice... You'd be able to make the right call.
It is the entire reason why road accident fund claims take so long, because in the initial stages, a person will try to settle with the road accident fund, but the thing that prolongs it for so long is these medical assessments that you have to do in order to capture the real depth and the impact of the injury.
Mm.
So with COIDA, it doesn't allow for such a detailed procedure where the injuries and the impact that they've had on you physiologically, psychologically, and otherwise are assessed, and the impact that they'll have on your entire life and just and not just on your employability. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Just to jump on that.
Yeah, just give me 1 second. I've been dying to ask Albert this. I mean, I don't want to, lose the opportunity. Albert, something that seemed surprising to me, that was being hailed as a new development, was the issue of domestic workers. Do you want to talk to me about that? I know you've sort of had some thoughts around it.
So yes, definitely. But I would just like to just take one step back and say that there's not a lot that I can add on what Advocate Nasima just said. Save for the fact that COIDA tries to speed up compensation for the individual.
Mm.
And also for the service providers.
Mm.
And that is why I think, there is this perception that COIDA looks after the employee and his workability. Now, coming to the domestic workers, what Njongo also referred to is, the time delays. And as an employers organization, we are highly concerned, because we not only represent commercial employers, we also represent employers of domestic workers. Now, with the domestic workers that are also now covered after the recent Constitutional Court case, where in the past, a domestic worker has not been, was not covered for an injury on duty,
mm-hmm.
and they just had to take care of themselves. But with this ruling from the Constitutional Court, the domestic worker employers also now have to register as employers, and the employees can now also lodge claims in the cases of occupational injuries and diseases. Our concern from the employees organization side regarding COIDA and the administration is, while they have so many issues at the moment with time delays, what, you know, before the domestic workers now also qualify, what is the effect going to be with another 800,000 to 1.3 million domestic workers now also being able, you know, being registered and can lodge claims? Not that all of them will lodge claims, but it will definitely have an effect on the workload and how it will be treated. And you must remember that a domestic worker does not only refer to your domestic helper in the household, but also refers to your gardener, your chauffeur, your nanny, the caregiver looking after the elderly or...
And here's a more worrying category for me, Albert, is a lot of people don't have full-time domestic help. So you'd find one person, and it applies as well to gardeners. One person does a garden or cleans for three different households in a week. And if somebody's working for you twice a week, what are your obligations and what are the obligations of the other two employers?
Well, I think that is the biggest misconception that there is at the moment, that employers regard a domestic worker who works one or two or even 3 days in a week for you as a temp or as a casual or some odd names or you know, functions that these people do. But the thing is that every domestic worker who works for you, whether she works one day or 6 or 7 days in a week for you, is an employee.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at the Unemployment Insurance Fund Act, if an employee works more than 24 hours in a month for you, that employee must be registered in terms of the Unemployment Insurance Fund. Now, as an employer of a domestic worker, where and now it includes the garden, the person coming in on Saturdays to work in your garden, that person will have to be registered, or you as the employer has to be registered. Because if that guy gets onto a bucky, you take your garden...
Operates a lawnmower,
And he falls off the bucky, or the dog bites him, or he gets electrocuted by the lawnmower, or something like that. I mean, that person will then be entitled to claim from COIDA. And if you as an employer is not registered, Department of Labor is going to come for you.
Yeah.
They will not jeopardize the employee's position. But the employers will have to register and will have to contribute.
And I think maybe the important point to say, just to, you know, take the opportunity as well. I mean, when I work, I want to know that I'm protected. So if somebody works for me, I think I should afford them the same courtesy.
Exactly. It cuts both ways.
Mm.
But it even goes further, that a domestic worker that works, and a domestic worker will not come and work for you and then ask you, where's my contract of employment? Or at the end of the month, where's my payslip?
Mm.
Because they feel that they will jeopardize their positions.
But it's also like customarily, just, you know, very casual, the relationship, you know, historically, where, you know...
Exactly. But until you get to the CCMA and you must now go and explain, you know, are you as the employer compliant with all the legislation? And, you know, the domestic sector is regarded as an informal sector. And that is another big misconception. There are so many laws that are applicable to a domestic worker and her employer. All the responsibility of compliance lies with the employer.
Advocate Rasasimola and you, Albert, clear me on this. The person has got 2, 3, 4 employers that they work more than 24 hours for per month. How is that handled? We all have to pay... You know, because because there would be something of an over contribution.
No.
If we all register,
there shouldn't be an over contribution, because you must remember that employee will work pro rata of a monthly salary will come from the different employers. And the employer is going to, as we understand that the commissioner is looking at the contributions, and it also works like that commercially. You as an employer will contribute a percentage of the remuneration.
Yeah.
So, you know, the five people, if she works for five different people in a week, five different people will at the end of the day contribute percentage of the full month salary. So it will be an overpayment or anything like that, but the thing is that the employers have to register, and the employees will then know that they are covered.
Good, Advocate Rasasimula, your closing remarks. I got 2 minutes to go.
I'll just put the closing remarks in terms of this domestic workers issue, mm-hmm. to say that definitely it has been deemed as an informal sector, although it has been the backbone of the South African economy for time immemorial, for such a long time. And I think it's very good that the Constitutional Court did what it did. But I think there's still an indictment on the Department of Labor and Employment to then deal with the regulatory framework around that and deal with some of the issues that have to do with definitions of and procedures in terms of how things are going to work, because otherwise there's going to definitely be a floodgate of other cases that deal with other parts of this if the department does not deal with it legislatively and deal with or create legislation that covers for domestic workers that work under the conditions that they work in.
All right, I think we're going to have to close it there. Thank you very much to all my guests, Albert van der Merwe. Thank you very much, Albert.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much to you too, Advocate Musima Rasasimula, as well as to you, Njongo Ngalunkulu, for sharing your story. I think that it inspired this show. So thank you very much for that. And to you, Afropolitan, thank you very much. I'm back again next Wednesday. Until then, keep well. Big Black is up next.
Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind. Visit kayafm.co.za for more.